Well, today we are going to be starting with the last part of Numbers chapter 14. We covered Numbers 14, 1 through 25 last week. We saw the bad report. It was a time where we see the reaction to the bad report from the spies that went into the land of promise that God had given them. And the spies were very positive about the land, but very negative about, and even very defeatist about, the possibility of occupying the land. And led the people to conclude it was totally and undeniably impossible to take the land as promised by God. And, of course, we have the exception that shows up multiple times of Caleb being the voice of it, but Caleb and Joshua would have been of a different mind. But the more they talked, the more their detractors or the negative people talked and even began to greatly exaggerate what they were seeing. They really saw themselves, the people in the majority, as their only resource. They never mentioned their faith in God, their faith in God's role, the promises that God had made. And so they were very defeated as they neared the end of the day. In chapter 14, then, we see the reaction of the people after they reached the conclusion. They wailed and cried out. They were just, that night, they were upset. They grumbled against, of course, Moses and Aaron. They revoiced their wishes that they had died in Egypt or in the wilderness. And when they finally mentioned God, the only thing they really say about God is, "Why did Jehovah bring us to this land?" That was a great question that should have been answered, but they didn't answer it. The question was there to really as an accusation of God, that he wanted them to fall by the sword, to see their wives and their children become plunder. And that was what they were thinking. And so they came to the conclusion that it would be best to return to Egypt. So they were going to appoint a leader to take them back. What probably was wrong with the assumptions that they were making as they considered that? What would have been the issues if they'd have gone, said, okay, if they'd appointed a leader and headed for Egypt? What kinds of things were they assuming that probably weren't true? Now, we're assuming what they were assuming, but you know.
But who's going to feed them and keep their shoes from wearing all the stuff?
It took God to get them here. Now they're going to go back on their own? What other assumptions? That's one huge category that is half of what I was thinking about. There's another big one. Yeah, when they get to Egypt, are they going to be, "Oh, we're so glad you're back. We've missed you. Let's have a nice party." No, it's not going to work. But Moses and Aaron fall on their faces. Joshua and Caleb tore their clothes. Caleb's the one that spoke up at this point and says, "Wait, this land is great. If Jehovah is pleased with us, he will give us the land." He's bringing God into the discussion in a good way. He calls the people, "Don't rebel. Don't fear the people. Their protection has been removed. It's been taken away." And, of course, how did the Israelites react? "Well, let's stone these guys. They're making noises we don't like." And, of course, at that moment, the glory of Jehovah appeared. And all of that talk is not discussed anymore in Numbers. And Jehovah says to Moses, "How long will they spurn me, not believe in me, despite the signs I've done?" God says, "I'm going to smite them and make you great." And it's very much like what God said after the time of the golden calf. And Moses' response is very much like it was at the time of the golden calf. "If you do that, the Egyptians will hear about it. They'll say your strength brought him here, but the people of the promised land that live there, they're going to hear it. But you couldn't bring them in, so you killed them." Basically, Moses is saying to God, "You can't. You're going to destroy your own reputation if you do that." And he quoted back to Jehovah his own words at the forgiveness time of the golden calf. "You're slow to anger. You're abundant in loving kindness, forgiving the iniquity and the transgressions, not clearing the guilty, but bringing the guilty to the third and fourth generations." And Moses says, "Pardon, I pray, these people according to your power." I'm sorry, "according to your loving kindness." And so And we talk about this every time it comes up. It isn't that God's going to transfer the guilt to the third and the fourth generations, but these sins affect their society, their culture, and God lets that effect carry forward. And God responds in a good way. God said, well, I have pardoned them. I mean, it's already a past tense, has been done issue. And he also says, and the earth will be filled with my glory. But he also talks about consequences. And all who have seen my glory tested me these 10 times. And we went through a probable list of those 10 times. Those that have not listened to my voice will not see the land of the promise. And he calls out Caleb. He said he's been different. He will enter, he will take possession, and he will have an inheritance there. And God goes ahead to say the Amalekites and the Canaanites live in the valleys, and tomorrow you're going to start for the wilderness by the way of the Red Sea, which is the last verse in the first 25, which takes us to verse 26 we're going to start today. But I want to stop on that verse 25 just a minute more. Here's a question. Have they met the Amalekites before? What do you think? I got one no, but I'm getting more of these. When did they meet the Amalekites before? Do you remember roughly what part of their experiences since Egypt they met the Amalekites? It was fairly early in the journey. They were crossing south of the Negev, the wilderness of Negev, that place in there south of the promised land for all practical purposes. They were in the area where they pretty much started their spying out this time. And this is the great battle where they had asked the Amalekites to let them pass through, and instead the Amalekites attacked them. And Moses is out there, and while he holds his hand up, they're winning, but he gets tired. When his hands come down, they don't. So, now I'm going to forget who was there with him. Aaron and
Joshua.
What's that? Yeah, it might have been his father-in-law. No, Joshua's down leading the battle. But at any rate, when they hold his hands up, then they're winning. And so God says, you're headed to the Amalekites, and the Canaanites also live in the valleys. Tomorrow, you're going to start for the wilderness, basically in this general area where the Amalekites were. You're going to go by way of the Red Sea. And what's interesting in that is, from where they weren't far from there, but it would have been a northern trip. And God says, no, you're going to go the south route. Yes, sir. Aaron and Hur, that's right, thank you. And Hur, by the way, is Caleb's father, if I've got my memory right, which is becoming more rare and rare every day. Yes, and so he says, no, go down by the way of the Red Sea, go down a southern route back into the area of the valleys. And so they're headed basically toward the Negev again, but instead of going up in the general direction of the promised land, God is sending them away from the promised land and taking a route to get there that would be opposite. Clearly, you're not headed for the promised land on this part of your journey, is implied in the directions that God gives. Now, I've got one more question about the Amalekites. Who are they named after?
Amalek.
And Amalek is a descendant of who?
Ishmael.
All good guesses, but we're not there yet.
Esau.
That's right. It's Jacob's brother, twin, that was not selected to be the child of the promise that the Amalekites are descended from ultimately. And so this is probably the closest kinship they have that they're dealing with on this. So with that said, let's look and begin with verse 26 of Numbers 14, and I'm going to read down through verse 35. Okay. The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, How long shall I bear with this evil congregation who are grumbling against me? I have heard the complaints of the sons of Israel, which they are making against me. Say to them, as I live, says the Lord, just as you have spoken in my hearing, so I will surely do to you. Your corpses will fall in this wilderness, even all your numbered men, according to your complete number, from 20 years old and upward, who have grumbled against me. Surely you shall not come into the land which I swore to settle to you, except Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, the son of Nun. Your children, however, whom you said would become prey, I will bring them in, and they will know the land which you have rejected. But as for your corpses, they will fall in the wilderness. Your sons shall be shepherds for 40 years in the wilderness, and they will suffer for your unfaithfulness until your corpses lie in the wilderness, according to the number of days which you spied out the land, 40 days. For every day you shall bear your guilt a year, even 40 years, and you will know my opposition. I, the Lord, have spoken. Surely this I will do, and all this evil congregation who are gathered together against me. In this wilderness they shall be destroyed, and there they will die. As for the men whom Moses sent to spy out the land, who returned and made all the congregation grumble against him by bringing out a bad report concerning the land, even those who brought out the very bad report of the land died by plague before the Lord. But Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh remained alive out of those men who went to spy out the land. So God talks to now Moses and Aaron, and it's interesting that Aaron is back in this leadership role in a more noticeable way after some time not being mentioned. But God asks a question: how long will I put up with this evil congregation, their public grumbling about me? I've heard their complaints. Tell them, in the same way that I'm alive, which they believed in the reality of God, even the grumblers, but they would ignore him all the time and complain about him. Tell them, as I live, I heard you speak. I heard what you said, and I'm going to do the same for you. Just like you said, your dead bodies will lie in the wilderness. All your numbered men, age 20 and up, the ones who grumbled, you will not enter the land. It was promised to you by Abraham, but there are two that the promise will still continue with, and that's Caleb and Joshua. Now, it's interesting, when he gets to the children, what does he say about their children? What did the people say about their children? They're going to become prey. They're going to be victims. They're going to get killed out here. Our women and our children are going to be essentially fodder in the fight. And what does God say is going to happen with their children?
They're going to get the land.
Your land, they're going to get it. They weren't the adults, because 20 and above, those were the ones numbered as the warriors to go in and do what God planned in the land of Canaan. You're not going, but your children who you despaired about, they're going. Now, they're going to suffer with you, but I will bring them in, and they will know the land that you rejected. It's interesting. Did they reject the land? If you asked them, are you rejecting this land? What might they have said?
No, we're rejecting the
people. No, it's the people that are there, not the land, but the only way they were going to be there and to get into the land was by following God, and they rejected God, so that works out the same way. And how did he determine that they were going to be marching around for 40 years? One year for every day that you spied out the land. One year for every day you invested in figuring out that you didn't think the land could be taken. That would be a miserable 40 years in many ways, wouldn't it? And God goes on in verse 35 to say, I, Jehovah, the Lord, have spoken. This evil congregation that gathered against me in this wilderness, they will be destroyed and they will die. And so that's what the people have to look forward to. 40 years in the wilderness, marching around, going nowhere, waiting for all the 20-year-olds and older to die. Almost to make it a celebration when the death occurred, wouldn't it? The person that died would be free from the wandering, and we'd be one person closer to getting rid of all those that are keeping us out of the promised land. But what happened to the leaders, the other 10, not Joshua and Caleb, but what happened to the other 10?
God killed them off by plague.
Yep, they died by plague. There's not much else said, but they died by plague. And I want to go back. Go back to Numbers 13:2 for just a minute. It's just a few pages back. It's an easy shift. And this is a description of the men, one aspect of them that was to be part of what was the choosing of them. 13:2, send out for yourselves men so they may spy out the land of Canaan, which I'm going to give to the sons of Israel. That's part of the selection. Send the spies out to see the land I'm going to give you. You shall send a man from each of their father's tribes. And here's a key point. Every one of them a leader in the tribe. So the leaders were selected. And the leaders did lead, didn't they? When they got back, they led their tribes to despair, to be angry, and all of the things that angered God. They led. Yep, they were leaders. They weren't going to be leading anymore. They were killed by plague. But in verse 38, we see that Joshua and Caleb are going to survive the wilderness walks, and they are going to be alive at the end and go into the promised land. Questions or comments so far? Yeah, and the details of Moses is not going at this point aren't revealed.
Right.
And frankly, God has left Moses and probably Aaron, because when they're sending out the spies, Aaron's tribe, the Levites, weren't going to be a part of that. It was the two tribes of Joseph that made it up to 12, and so that the Levites did not get an inheritance. They were going to get other things, but not be a tribe with land holdings in the same fashion as the 12 tribes that would. This is my conclusion about from what I've read. I would say Moses and Aaron were probably not, they probably didn't know what God's plans were for them, that they would not be entering. It's probably an unknown at that point.
I just thought it was interesting.
Yeah, well, it works out in an interesting way before it's done, that's for sure. So let's go. Anything else? So back in Numbers 14, let's read verses 39 through 45. When Moses, so far God has told Moses, go tell the people. Okay, now Moses is going to tell the people. When Moses spoke these words to all the sons of Israel, they mourned greatly. In the morning, however, they rose up early and went up to the ridge of the hill country, saying, here we are. We have indeed sinned, but we will go up to the place which the Lord has promised. But Moses said, why then are you transgressing the commandment of the Lord when it will not succeed? Do not go up, or you will be struck down before your enemies. For the Lord is not among you. For the Amalekites and the Canaanites will be there in front of you, and you will fall by the sword, inasmuch as you have turned back from the following of the Lord. And the Lord will not be with you. But they went up heedlessly to the ridge of the hill country. Neither the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord nor Moses left the camp. When the Amalekites and the Canaanites who lived in that hill country came down and struck them and beat them down as far as Hormah. So, here's the people. What did they place their faith in determining that the country could not be taken? What did they look at for their resources to go take this country when they were grumbling and saying it can't be done?
Themselves.
Okay, so now God has told them, well, I was going to do it for you. But that's past for those of you that are 20 years and older. And so it says in verse 39, Moses spoke the words, and the people mourned greatly. What did they mourn, do you suppose? Well, a piece of it would be what God decided. What else? Didn't they have to regret how they had responded the first time? Well, you wouldn't know it by their actions very well. Because they get up early in the morning and they're looking at the ridge of the hill country, and they're headed there, and they say, yes, we sinned, but we're going to go up to the land promised by Jehovah, by the Lord. And so now, do they think they're going to go up and be successful? Isn't it the same people that they saw before? And how they saw themselves as grasshoppers? And they saw us as grasshoppers, they said. I mean, all that exaggeration they did, they really didn't obviously fully mean it. And now somehow they've got it in their heads, they can go do this. When they weren't going to be given the privilege of doing it because they said it couldn't be done. There's something wrong with their thinking, right? So what did Moses ask of them in verse 41? Why are you transgressing or going against the command of Jehovah? Why are you doing that? Moses doesn't say to them the obvious. You said that couldn't be done. Why are you going to go try to do it? Isn't this suicide? Because the issue is more, what did God say and what is God's will? What did Jehovah declare to you? And why are you going to go against that? They've got a pretty good record in terms of consistency. Whatever God says to do, they go the other direction, right? I'm going to give you this land. Go spy it out. We can't have that land. Where did that come from? That wasn't even a part of the spying. Okay? And then when they get back, if they've thoroughly convinced themselves, angered God, complained, grumbled, why didn't we die already? Well, let's go back to Egypt, because this is a pointless exercise. Then when God says, okay, you can't have the land, let's go get the land. Yeah, well, except that with your three-year-old, you can say, you'll grow up, you'll learn. God's looking at these people going, you're not going to grow up, you never learn. And they don't. And Moses points it out to them. He gives them a command in verse 42, don't go up. If you do, you're going to be struck down. And it will be done by your enemies. Why? Jehovah's not going with you. You've come to think that things will work the way they've been working, but that the way they've been working is with Jehovah with you. You're on your own now. As a matter of fact, not only not with you, you're rebelling against him as you do it. If God does something, it's going to be in the level of a curse in your direction rather than some sort of help. In verse 43, Moses says, the Amalekites and the Canaanites will face you. They will defeat you. You will die by the sword. Oh, by the way, that makes you a prophet. When you don't depend on God, you can prophesy your future pretty well to these people, he said. You've turned from following the Lord. He's not with you. But they paid as much attention to Moses as you might expect. They went up heedlessly, paid no attention. They went to the ridge, and they were very heedlessly. That word, I looked it up. Presumptuously would be another way to talk about that. Another one would be boldly. They were determined and, we're going to show you kind of a boldness is probably a part of that. So they went up to the ridge. What did not go with them? What stayed in the camp, huh? The Ark of the Covenant. No point in taking the ark. They weren't doing anything out of any agreement with God, right? And Moses, I'm not going to go watch you guys die. You can do that all by yourself. I don't need to be a part of that. I don't know what Moses was thinking. He probably was greatly saddened. But he stayed in the camp. And the result, the Amalekites and the Canaanites came down. They struck them down as far as Hormah. It was a rout. Where's Hormah? We don't have any real good, definite ideas. But many people think it was somewhere around Beersheba, or maybe what you might even call Gaza today. Many people put it in that area. Why, I don't know. But at any rate, it was a running retreat. So why did they go? Well, they just were not too concerned about God's directions. They just wanted what they wanted when they wanted it. And so they sinned against God. They did their own things to get there. Got a couple of passages I want to go look at. Let's start with James chapter 4. And we're going to look at verses 13 through 16. James 4, 13 through 16. And of course, now we're talking to a Christian audience when James is writing. James, the brother of Christ, who, by the way, wasn't much of a believer while Jesus was alive. The only times they're really talked about when his brothers say, hey, you ought to go on up to Jerusalem and show them just how wonderful you are. The scriptures tell us they were trying to send him up there because they weren't believers. They didn't want good for him. And he said, no, my time's not here yet. And then he went up a little later, and they did see him preaching in the temple area. But here's James, this great writer, gives us lots of very personal attitudes and actions to put into life. Clearly, he was close to his brother Jesus, at least in a spiritual way, before it was over. And here's what he says in James 14, beginning in verse 13. Come now, you who say today or tomorrow, we will go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit. Yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You are just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that. But as it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Therefore, to one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin. Working in the workaday world and in the business world, I mean, you're constantly living with, well, 5-year plans and 3-year plans and 1-year plans and sometimes even longer. And yet, one of the rules almost when you make the plans is, well, it's got to be adaptable. You can't just plan it and then run your plan without stopping and thinking every once in a while, because things don't go the way you want them to. The conditions under which you made the plan change. I mean, you can go through lots of discussion about all of that. And of course, in the workaday world, I had some exceptions to this because I work for some Christian men at times. But in the workaday world, they're not stopping to think about, well, is this really what God wants us to do? But that we can do that in the Christian world too. As a matter of fact, if you're in church leadership, you ought to be doing some thinking about where ought we be in 5 years? Meaning, where do we have weaknesses? Where should we be growing? What's the Lord called us to work on? I mean, some of these conversations are fine, but when you're all done, the prayer needs to be, Lord, you take us where you want us to go. Don't let us become arrogant in our planning. Lead us as we do the planning, and so those kinds of things. But things don't go like you expect, do they? I mean, life just doesn't do what you think it's going to do. Sometimes the circumstances get better. And sometimes they really get worse. And so we have to be looking instead to, God, what would you have me do in the circumstances as they now are? And what James says is, if the Lord wills and we live, then we'll go do thus and so. And that if the Lord wills is a big deal. Go to Psalm 127:1. Whoops, Psalms is over here. This is a verse often spoken, but I'm wondering sometimes how often we really mean it or think about it as we're making our plans for the minute, for the day, for the year. This is a really important verse. It's from Solomon. Unless the Lord builds a house, starting at 127:1, unless the Lord builds a house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman keeps awake in vain. What's the point of this Psalm 127:1? What's the point? Is it about building houses? Maybe a little bit. You might set out to make yourself a... those of you who remember Steve Byer, he always talked about a new house being built as man's monument to man, and a lot of other people use that. But you may be setting out to build a really nice house for you and your family. But it's really not mainly about building houses, is it? What's it about?
Lord has to be the foundation.
Lord has to be the foundation.
He's sovereign.
The things that I set out to do today, if they're not the things the Lord wants done, I'm wasting my time. So what's the answer to that? Well, for some of us men, I'm one that struggles with this from time to time. The answer is, well, I just won't bother doing anything, then I won't be wasting my time, right? That's called laziness. That's evil in its own way. And that's a sin too. But we have to have some faith as we proceed through life that the Lord is leading us. Are we going to know exactly what the Lord wanted me to do first today? Well, maybe on Sunday I know I need to teach this. But otherwise, you get up in the day or you plan the week or you think about what's going to happen this month. God, he doesn't send me notes. If he's sending you notes, I want you to start asking him some questions for me. Okay? How do you know? Well, you have to have some faith. You have to be looking at the Word of God and making the things of God your priority. And that's not really often as easy as it is to say it. And, of course, God will chastise us because he loves us as children, and he'll move us over to that right path, sometimes forcefully if we're his children. But nonetheless, the Israelites didn't get this verse, did they? He could have written, when you get up to go conquer the country, you're acting in vain. You'll probably be defeated, but even if you win, it won't be a real victory to accomplish what you want unless the Lord is going with you. And we need to learn that lesson. We need to look at what went on with these Israelites when they did not get the fruits of their lives that they wanted because they rejected the leadership of the Lord to just simply fulfill a promise to them. They lost the opportunity to live in the promised land. And then they decide to fix their lost opportunity themselves. That's not going to work. And indeed, it didn't. Why did they go? They were just going to try to muscle through and get it done, even though they were no longer doing it God's way or under his leadership. Questions, comments, thoughts? Well, when we get to chapter 15, the content of the book turns a real corner. And it's kind of a surprising corner because we've just finished telling the Jews, the children of Israel, that are 20 years of age and older, except for Joshua and Caleb, and really the tribe of Levi is kind of indeterminate at this point, but we just told them Your only future is to die wandering around in the wilderness. Now, there will be other things that God leads them through and happen to them in the wilderness. But that, as far as that long-term future of the promised land, that's over. And yet, in chapter 15, let's see what God tells Moses to speak to them about next. I'm going to read the first 13 verses. Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you enter the land where you are to live, which I'm giving you, then make an offering by fire to the Lord, a burnt offering or a sacrifice to fulfill a special vow, or as a freewill offering in your appointed times, to make soothing aroma to the Lord from the herd, from the flock. The one who presents his offering shall present to the Lord a grain offering of 1/10 of an ephah, of fine flour mixed with 1/4 of a hin of oil, and you shall prepare wine for the drink offering, 1/4 of a hin, with the burnt offering or for the sacrifice with each lamb. Or for a ram you shall prepare as a grain offering 2/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with 1/3 of a hin of oil. And for the drink offering you shall offer 1/3 of a hin of wine as a soothing aroma to the Lord. When you prepare a bull as a burnt offering or a sacrifice to fulfill a special vow or for a peace offering to the Lord, then you shall offer with the bull a grain offering of 3/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with 1/2 of a hin of oil. And you shall offer the drink offering 1/2 a hin of wine as an offering by fire as a soothing aroma to the Lord. Thus it shall be done for each ox or for each ram, or for each of the male lambs, or of the goats, according to the number you prepare, so you shall do for everyone according to their number. All who are native shall do these things in this manner, in presenting an offering by fire as a soothing aroma to the Lord." So, the next thing out of God's direction, out of his voicing to Moses what to do, Jehovah says, tell the sons of Israel, and what he tells them about is, when you enter the land in which you are to live. And he's talking about the promised land. So part of their culture is they're still going to keep looking to the promised land, knowing full well that as we look to the promised land, we're talking about the next generation. And so they're going to be preparing the next generation to come into the promised land, and how there are, in this case, to worship God, to glorify him through sacrifices that they will make upon their entry into the promised land. A land, God says, that I will give you. It's going to be an offering by fire to Jehovah, a burnt offering of sacrifice, or to fulfill a special vow, or a freewill offering in your appointed time. So, and later on, he's even going to talk about the peace offering. So he says, when you get there, here's how you make offerings by fire. And it's still an emphasis on the coming time when they will be in the promised land as a nation, even though the bulk of the people won't be a part of it. He talks about in verses 4 and 5, the one that's presenting the offering, and this is the simplest of the offerings, is to bring with it a tenth of an ephah of fine flour and 1/4 of a hin of oil. Now, the fine flour, an ephah, is about a gallon. So they're going to bring it's a fairly small amount of flour, and with it they're going to have a hin of oil, and a hin is somewhere around 3 to 4 quarts. And I'm sorry, I misspoke, I believe. And I don't have the resource with me. I said in my notes, it says an ephah is, okay, now I can read it, 4 to 6 gallons. We're going to say that right. So a tenth is going to be more. It's going to be a tenth of, say, 5 gallons. So it would be about a half a gallon of flour. And a quarter of a hin of oil, and a hin's, they said, 6 to 8 pints, so somewhere between a small gallon. And so they're going to have 1/4 of a hin of oil. And then they bring also with that a drink offering, wine, again, a fourth of a hin, with the burnt offering for each lamb. So we're talking about primarily a lamb offering here. But then he goes on to say in verses 6 and 7, but if you're offering a ram, it goes up to 2/10 of an ephah of fine flour, and 1/3 of a hin of oil, and 1/3 of a hin of wine. In verses 8 through 10, he says, if you're bringing a bull as a burnt offering, or as a special vow, or a peace offering, now you're going to be bring 3/10, it keeps going up, 3/10 of an ephah of flour, and 1/2 of a hin of oil, and a drink offering, 1/2 of a hin of wine. And all of this, in each one of these cases, he says it's an offering by fire to make a soothing aroma for Jehovah. And he sums it up in verses 11 through 13, for each ox, ram, male lambs, or goats, according to the number prepared, do for everyone according to their numbers. And this is for the natives, or the actual descendants of Israel. And so it talks about a soothing aroma to Jehovah. Do you think God just has a special place in his heart for the smell of these animals burning? Is that what this is about? I get a, but I don't, so what is it about?
Obedience?
Yes, that would be a big, big important part of it. But let's see if we can go a little further with it. What's this about?
In the Psalms, isn't it say the sacrifice of praise? Maybe that's a soothing aroma.
Well, there certainly is. There are things written in the Psalms about a sacrifice of praise. This is worship, isn't it? It's worship. It is obedience. You can't be anything but obedient if you're going to worship God. And so God has said, this is how you're going to show your worship of me, your honoring of me. This is to glorify God. And as the people do what God asked, as they make these sacrifices, and as they see, particularly when they're talking about a burnt offering, which is a dedication offering to God, or when they're talking about sin offerings, they're seeing that this shows my devotion to God. This shows my appeal for his forgiveness. It shows my obedience in doing what he's asked me to do as a part of my worship. All of these things are about honoring Jehovah God. And the sacrifices may change some based on what you have, will determine a bit what you can sacrifice. If all you have are lambs, you're going to sacrifice a lamb. But for the person with multiple flocks, it may get clear up to a bull, or maybe even multiple bulls. And so the sacrifice may vary, but the meaning behind it doesn't. And so God says, when you get there, this is a focus for you, are these sacrifices. And so God is already pointing them to head to when you get there, you're going to be worshiping me. You're going to be obedient to me. You're going to worship me. And as you might imagine, he's not real interested in shortcuts. He's been very specific here. So he expects them to be very specific in following the instructions he's given. It's not just that something needed to die on a fire or die and then be burnt. No, there is a prescribed way, and God expects them to do that. And that's his message to them here. So already the focus is on worship. Questions, comments, thoughts? All right, well, let's go down to verse 14 then in chapter 15. This is going to be a longer passage. We'll may or may not get all the way through it, but let's take a shot at it. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you enter the land where I bring you, Then it shall be that when you eat of the food of the land, you shall lift up an offering to the Lord. Of the first of your dough, you shall lift up a cake as an offering. As the offering is offering of the threshing floor, so you shall lift it up. From the first of your dough you shall give to the Lord an offering throughout your generations. But when you unwittingly fail and do not observe all the commandments which the Lord has spoken to Moses, even all that the Lord has commanded you through Moses, from the day when the Lord gave the commandment and onward throughout your generations, then it shall be, if it is done unintentionally without the knowledge of the congregation, that all the congregation shall offer one bull for a burnt offering as a soothing aroma to the Lord, with its grain offering and its drink offering according to the ordinance, and one male goat for a sin offering. Then the priest shall make atonement for all the congregation of the sons of Israel, and they will be forgiven, for it was an error. And they have brought their offering, an offering by fire to the Lord, and their sin offering before the Lord for their error. So all the congregation of the sons of Israel will be forgiven with the alien who sojourns among them, for it happened to all the people through error. Also, if one person sins unintentionally, then he shall offer a one-year-old female goat for a sin offering. The priest shall make atonement before the Lord for the person who goes astray when he sins unintentionally, making atonement for him that he may be forgiven. You shall have one law for him who does anything unintentionally, for him who is a native among the sons of Israel, and for the alien who sojourns among them. But the person who does anything defiantly, whether he is native or an alien, that one is blaspheming the Lord, and that person shall be cut off from among his people, because he has despised the word of the Lord and has broken his commandment. That person shall be completely cut off. His guilt will be on him. And so God starts to deal with how they are going to reckon with God in sins that occur. And he starts off with, in verse 14, did I skip that earlier? No. If an alien is there with you, somebody who's not a descendant of Jacob, with you, or one who throughout your generations he wishes to make an offering by fire, he shall do just as you do. And in verse 15 he says, and as for the whole group, as for the assembly, there will be one statute for you and for the alien who sojourns with you, a perpetual statute throughout your generations as you are, so shall the alien be before the Lord. And what God has done right here, he said, like in verse 16, I'll read that too, one law, one ordinance for you and for the one who's sojourning with you. And what he's talking about here in a sojourner is it could be the traveler that's passing through for a few days, but the real focus here is more so on the person that comes and resides with you and becomes a part of your people. That you're not going to distinguish between them. If they're going to be here with you, then they're going to be worshiping in the same manner as you are. They're going to deal with sin in the same manner as you are. And that's how it's going to work. One ordinance will treat all the same. And then he starts talking to them after that about the dealing with their sins. And I'm sorry, I'm wrong. I skipped something in my notes here. He deals with when they first get their harvest in the new land in verses 17 and following. He says, when you get your first food, then tell Israel at that point in the land you're eating its food, you lift up an offering for Jehovah. The focus is still Jehovah's fulfillment of the promise. He's given you a land flowing with milk and honey, and now this is an offering of your first fruits. It's the first time you're harvesting on this new land, and you're going to make a dough with that grain offering. You're going to lift it up. It's going to be a cake offering to the Lord. It's coming. The grain comes from the threshing floor. You're going to lift it up for all to see. It's going to be a public worship of God, thankfulness. And this first offering is going to continue throughout their generations. It's much like the offering of first fruits. It's in that same category. And so that's going to be a part of their harvest, is when they get their first food to eat, that will be made as a grain offering of thanks to the Lord. But then he says, starting in verse 22, that if you have an unintentional failing, if you sin, and the whole congregation doesn't know it, there can be a congregational focus for all the people. The laws and commands that are given through Moses are to be in front of them continually for all generations. And when the congregation becomes aware, or even if they don't become aware, they can have a congregational offering of a bull as a burnt offering, also with grain and drink offerings, just as directed. And with that, they will add one male goat for a sin offering. And the priest will offer this up in the manner prescribed, and it says that he will make atonement for all the people, the Israelites. Remember, the priest has a role between God and men, and that role is to take their sacrifices before God to secure their atonement. That word atonement that's used here from the Hebrew has some, you can look at some nuances. One is purify. It can mean to reconcile. It can mean to obtain forgiveness. It can mean to cover over. So they're dealing with their sin in those fashions. And atonement then is intended to say it achieves that forgiveness. And he says so. They will be forgiven. If it was an error, then they can bring the offering by fire to Jehovah. The priest will work for their atonement. And then it takes care of their error. And verse 26, it says, so all the congregation will be forgiven, including the travelers with them. It was an error. Now, verses 27 through 29 deal with those sins made, again, with that word unintentional in front of it, as an individual. The person who sins unintentionally, so now I'm taking care of me rather than the congregation doing as a whole, can offer a one-year-old female goat as a sin offering. And again, in the offering time, the priest makes atonement before the Lord. So when the person goes astray, that atonement can be brought in so that he can be forgiven. And once again, it's emphasized one law for things done unintentionally for both Israelites and the sojourners, the ones that are there with them. But verses 30 and 31 are different. But if we have a person acting defiantly, that word is interesting because it emphasizes the hand. And it's talking about strength and intention. In other words, if you bring your hand against God, then whether it's an Israelite or a traveler, a sojourner, it is blaspheming Jehovah. And that word blaspheming is also interesting. Contained in this word is the idea of cutting or wounding, of denying, even reviling, profaning the sacred could be fit in there. It's when you call Jehovah evil, in a sense, in essence. And so you're blaspheming Jehovah. You're dragging his name through the mud. And if you are doing that, if you are acting defiantly in your sin, it's something you know you're doing, it's intentional, then you are to be cut off from the people. They've despised the word of God. They've drug it through the dirt. They've broken his commandment. They're to be completely cut off from the people. And I don't think there's any doubt about what this means when you get right down to it. This completely cut off, this is a death sentence. And his guilt will be on him. And as far as verses are concerned, we're not quite done, but that we're going to stop there and start with verse 32 next time. But I want to talk about this just a minute, because this sounds very different than what we know from our Christian experience, isn't it? When people sin today as Christians, is this what happens? If you were defiant to God, do you have a death sentence passed over you? Physically, here and now, and you go throughout eternity with your guilt? Well, we don't have to read very many verses. We could go to one that many of us have memorized very quickly, 1 John 1:9. If we confess our sins, He's faithful and righteous to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from that unrighteousness. There are many cases of sins in the New Testament. The apostles themselves collectively, and the fullness of the new kingdom wasn't here yet. Jesus had not yet been to the cross, but they collectively abandoned and denied Jesus in Peter's case, right? And yet they are the very foundation of the church. So we need to recognize as we read this, there's some principles here that we need to pay attention to. And part of them would even go back to what happened as they were spying out the land. Can you make God angry? Yes. Can that lead to immediate results in your life? Yes. Paul even talks about some of the people who were inappropriately observing communion didn't survive it. We've read the account of Ananias and Sapphira, right? How long did they last after their sin? But if there are death penalties as a result of sin, God is the one who brings them. The eye for an eye, the stoning of people is passed aside in terms of how God deals with us as a people in these days. Yet, are the stakes smaller? Now, we're talking about eternity. We're talking about dealing with our relationship with God in this life as well as for eternity. And so there are some differences. God was establishing a nation to be a clear witness for Him. And as a nation, their tolerance for sin and for defiance of God was established by God to be very low. And so there will be differences. Paul's got many chapters in the book of Romans about not living under the law, that the law was beyond what people could bear. And yet, even in the Old Testament, people were saved, weren't they? And they were saved by faith. And Christ's death on the cross even covered those sins out of their faith. They looked forward, we look backward, but it's the same sacrifice that pays the debt of sin of men in the eyes of God, and all that are saved by faith. So as we read these, let's recognize both parts of those things that are going on. Yes, God is dealing with their sin. He's calling them to a high standard, but He's also establishing a nation that is intended to have a very special, full, complete testimony of worship of God and who He is. And the people don't always do very well with it, but let's recognize there's more going on here than simply their eternal relationship with God Himself. Questions, comments? Some of these things are hard to understand, aren't they? Why these differences? Why this way of doing things? And the answer is, it's the way God chose, and who are we to question Him? That's a piece of it. It's not the only piece, but it's a piece. Questions, comments? All right, well, we'll pick it up with verse 32 next time.